This is Scott McCulloch for Now News and Events. On October 11, Tampa Bay Lightning Assistant General Manager Julien Brisebois came home to Concordia for Advancement and Alumni Relations up-close and personal lecture. The John Molson School of Business graduates sat down with CTV Montreal's Randy Thiemann for a conversation on the future of the NHL. Brisebois fielded questions that range from the impact young managers have on NHL clubs to the ongoing players' lockout. The talk wrapped up Concordia's 2012 homecoming festivities. Here's how it unfolded.
I know that you can't be a mind reader and you're not involved directly with the CBA talks. And as we have said, I know it's a delicate situation, but we can be optimistic.
I think so. I mean, it's a matter of time. There's no timeline on it. I wish I knew, but I don't. But eventually, NHL hockey will be back for sure. And I have great confidence it's going to come back better than ever, actually, just like it did last time.
This has obviously had to make things a little difficult business-wise in the Tampa Bay area, because we have, for so many years, heard all the conversations about making hockey survive and flourish in the Sun Belt. How has this affected the Tampa Bay Lightning?
Well, we'll only know once we come back and we see the actual consequences of the work stoppage. We have a very loyal fan base. They're not as numerous as they would be in Montreal or in other Canadian markets, but they're hardcore fans, and we hope they'll be back. And it'll be up to us to win them back once we do, by finding them, a winning team, a team they can be proud of. We have strong ownership that's very involved in the community, spent a lot of money giving back, found different ways to get involved in the community to help the Tampa area out of its, economic downturn. And, like I said, hopefully we'll be able to win our fans back as quickly as possible.
As we were talking about earlier, solid ownership is such a key. We've seen over the years what's been going on with the Phoenix Coyotes and that. Right now in Tampa, that's as solid as it has ever been. Tell me about the ownership.
Our owner is a gentleman by the name of Jeff Vinnick. He's a hedge fund manager. That's where he made his money. And he's just a terrific owner. Very passionate about hockey. Very passionate about the team. He bought the team for the right reasons. And he felt that it was very important for him as a major league sports owner, sports team owner, to give back to the community, get involved in the community. He's actually relocated his business, which used to be in Boston, this summer. All of his employees have moved down to Tampa. And those are relatively high-paying jobs, people buying houses in the area and spending money in the Tampa community. He spent $40 million of his own money on the building to renovate it last summer, or 2 summers ago. And he doesn't own the building. He just wants the fan experience to be that much better. And he's just a fabulous guy, very supportive, sets high standards for us in terms of what he wants the franchise to represent in that community. And made a great hire when he hired Steve Yzerman as general manager to oversee hockey operations. And it's kind of, we knew going in that it was going to be a rebuild. It was going to take some time, but we're on our way and we're optimistic we'll reach our goal.
Season ticket base?
I don't know if those numbers are public, but they're not Montreal numbers, but they're pretty good. Had we had a good start to the season last year, we thought we had a shot at maybe selling out the whole year. So it's not, sometimes we're compared to some of the other southern markets. Tampa's markets, it has a loyal fan base. They show up for games, and we do actually pretty well in terms of turnstile.
So the key, say, to surviving in that area, and like I say, not just surviving, but flourishing to the point where you don't break even, you actually make money, would be?
Well, it's going to take time. We have to build the business to that level. Part of that is what our costs are, but part of that is also growing revenue. And there's still some work to be done in that area.
Now, you said earlier, after the NBA had problems and had the lockout, they came back and people came back. You're confident that despite what happens here, that people are going to come back because they love their sports in that area?
You never know. You never know. Last time that's what happened in many markets, but not in all markets. So it's not something that we as hockey management people can take for granted.
Do you like the phrase capologist? You're a capologist.
I hear it in the media every now and then.
Right.
It doesn't really mean anything to me. That's not really what I do. I don't even know if that's a job description, but I know it's a title that I've kind of been labeled that way, and that's fine.
Is the money scale that is happening in the NHL, even if without the CBA, going back, say, 2 years ago or a couple of years ago, where revenue in the NHL obviously is increasing on a yearly basis since the past CBA. In your opinion, as a financial type guy, is everything in order as it kind of should be, even with pro sports in general? Or is it high, or is it just really what the markets will sustain?
In terms of?
Just salaries, overall, what the cap should be or shouldn't be for teams.
Again, I've tried to stay away because I want to get fined, and the breadth of the rule
no,
is
no, but even
wide.
Even just from without even just with the NHL, or even say the NBA or other pro sports, and I know you've been involved in other pro. Is the money say? Is everything out of whack, or is it sensible to a certain extent?
It's a relative question. It depends what you compare it to. Should our athletes make more than teachers or doctors? You can look at it that way. You can also look at what movie stars are making and say, well, in light of what movie stars are making, maybe it all makes sense. Really, there's no right or wrong answer to that question.
Is this something you've always wanted to do? How'd you get involved that you went this direction?
I didn't plan this out. It kind of happened serendipity, I guess. Right place at the right time. It started when I was hired out of law school by the law firm of Heenan Blakey. I interviewed there. And I was trying to sell myself, and throughout the course of my studies, I'd written an article on sports law that I was going to, it was about to get published, so I'm telling this lawyer who's interviewing me, well, I just wrote this article on sports law, I'm trying to sell myself a little bit, and he goes, oh, really? Well, that's interesting, because we're trying to start a sports law department. Now, I didn't know that. And he says, we're looking for someone who knows about sports, who's bilingual, who could, you know, do some of the legwork for us. And he said, you're going to meet the head of the department in your second interview. So I knew I was getting second interviews, that was pretty good.
That's a good thing.
Took some of the pressure off. And eventually I was hired. My plan really was to be a tax lawyer, but I kind of got derailed into sports law, and I was very fortunate. By the time I left Heenan Blakey to join the Canadiens, I was doing practically 100% sports law, whether it was Quebec Major Junior Hockey League, I was involved with them, some, you know, race car, some Formula One race car driving, some NASCAR issues, Major League Baseball, NHL teams. So I was right place at the right time. I got to work with some great people who had great files for me and who acted as mentors for me and who really taught me a lot in a short period of time and gave me a chance to be hired by the Montreal Canadiens and actually have a little something to contribute when I got there.
Before I follow up on that, because I don't want to forget, what's it like working with Steve Yzerman?
It's outstanding. You know, everyone knows him for the player that he was, the great career he had, the great captain he was, what he did for Team Canada. And he obviously brings a lot from a leadership standpoint to the table. But really, over the course of the last few years, I've worked with him. It's more than, like, I value him more as a friend than anything else. And I consider myself really blessed to have him as a friend. We chat about all sorts of things. We're together almost all the time. So we laugh. He's a really witty person. I know his public demeanor is that he's stoic and he's serious, but he's really funny and witty and smart, and I just enjoy working with him every day.
So what, like, he walks in during the day and the first thing he says is, hi, what can we do today? I mean, is it that kind of relationship?
Sometimes, but most of the time he comes in and says, okay, this is what we have to do today. So it's a little different.
We have to sell 5,000 season tickets.
No, but that's not his job. We have other great people to do that, but... And what I like to do, we get to really work on most things together. Usually we'll be on the call together, we'll be in the meeting together, we'll be strategizing together. We really have a close working relationship.
You obviously, or I shouldn't say obviously, but I'm guessing because you applied for the job as general manager of the Montreal Canadiens, that at some time in the future you would love to be the general manager of an NHL hockey team.
If the opportunity presents itself, of course, like, if I consider myself an ambitious person. I'm in the hockey management world. The highest ring on the ladder is general manager of an NHL hockey team. If that presents itself, then I'll certainly consider it. And if I'm lucky enough to have that opportunity someday, then hopefully I'll be successful.
You've had success at the American Hockey League level with, obviously, Hamilton and now with Syracuse, which is the farm team of Tampa Bay. They just moved to Syracuse. You like it? You like being involved as a general manager of the AHL teams?
I do, both with the Montreal organization when I ran Hamilton and Tampa, where I run the farm team there as well. I was given a lot of latitude to run it. So it's kind of my baby, and I got to hire most of the people that are involved and pick the players and work with the scouts to do that, work with the coaches on a day-to-day basis. So, I find it very gratifying.
What was the first, I don't know if you would call it a cultural shock, to go from, say, the mecca of hockey here where, and I'm sure you'd find it in this crowd as well, to just, you can't breathe in this city without someone mentioning the Montreal Canadiens. Everywhere I go, I can go to a poker tournament, sit and play poker for 8 hours, and there isn't one conversation about anything other than the Montreal Canadiens, and now you're in Tampa.
It's different. It's the level of the passion that's different. But I was surprised. My wife and I, when we moved to Tampa, we started looking for houses. We were surprised by the number of little boys and little girls that had Steve Stamkos or Vinny LeCavalier posters in their bedrooms, hockey sticks in the garage or in the driveway. The brand is pretty strong in the marketplace. It's been there, we are celebrating our 20th anniversary this year, so it's only been 20 years, but it's been 20 years. The game has grown in that market, and I think people who live here have a certain opinion of the level of interest that people in Tampa might have for hockey, but it's greater than that. The problem there was that they'd had a few rough years, and we had to win the trust back of the fans. But they were there. We just had to win them back one at a time.
Is the key still the product on the ice more than anything else?
I think so. It's the same everywhere. In certain markets, it has more impact. We might be one of those markets. When the team has been successful there, the fans were there. They were there in 2004 when they won the Cup, and they were there 2 years ago when we got to the conference finals. And they were there last year, and we hope they'll be there when we come back.
From the ownership that was in Tampa Bay to the ownership now, obviously, and we've heard the stories about, plain and simple, it was a mess. From when you got there, when Steve Yzerman got there, obviously you had a lot of work to do.
Well, they had no resources. When we got there, they had stripped the place to the bone. So we had to rebuild the organization, almost as if it was an expansion franchise. With the difference that we had some players already in place, some really good players, but from a structure and organization and leadership standpoint, it was a complete rebuild. So that's why we knew it would take some time, and that was perfect for me because at that time I was looking for a new challenge, and that was a great challenge.
How did all, from a school standpoint, how did all this totally prepare you for what you're doing now?
Just like in any other field, you learn more on the job than anywhere else. I went to law school and I got my law degree, but I really learned to be a lawyer when I joined the firm. I was already in management when I did my MBA here, so I already had a little bit of experience. But what I picked up in my executive MBA are tools, like just the knowledge that there are tools. There are better ways of doing things. Some people have studied way of doing things, and there's a good way to hire someone, and there's a good way to put a marketing plan in place. And there's a lot of HR tools I picked up when I was here. I actually exchanged emails this week with Professor Applebaum, who was my HR teacher during my MBA, and I told him, I used some of the things I learned from him to put together a hiring process that I've used to hire AHL coaches. Well, I've hired two coaches with that process, and they were both Coach of the Year. So part of that might be luck, part of that might be we're at the right place at the right time, but I think that by using the right process, I increase my odds of being successful. And those are the types of things that I picked up here.
You talked about processes of hiring. When you went through the process, were you as prepared as you thought you would be for the whole process of trying to become a general manager of, say, the Montreal Canadiens?
I think so. Like, I felt prepared. It went well. I don't know that I changed anything.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How long a process was it? I know you can't get into
without any details. It was a pretty lengthy project. It was a number of weeks. I don't remember the specifics, but it took a number of time.
When you came out, did you think you had the job?
No, I didn't know. It's hard to tell.
Hard to tell?
I knew I was pleased with what I had to say, and after that, it was out of my hands. And
It's obviously it's going to be different this year in the American Hockey League, depending on how long the lockout goes. There are players playing in the American Hockey League. We've certainly seen what the Edmonton Oilers have done this past week with their team. That league has just got a whole lot better because of all this.
This is good. This right now, I kid it to some friends of mine in the audience a little earlier, but it's the best league in the world right now. The American Hockey League is the best hockey league in the world, and that's what we told our players when we started the camp a couple weeks ago. They shouldn't want to be anywhere else. The level of competition will be at its highest it's ever been in league history, and it's going to be as close to NHL hockey as anywhere else in the world.
When you look at hockey and...
That being said, there are tickets on sale for the November 19th. The Hamilton Bulldogs are playing a Syracuse Crunch, so if you need a hockey fix, November 9th.
And if you need it, can't wait until then, the University Hockey with Kevin Fixley, the head coach of the Stingers right here. Tomorrow afternoon, the ladies get underway, 2:30 in the afternoon. Check it out. I've always said it's one of the best-kept secrets in town. I love college hockey. When you see the hockey madness, I always call it the hockey madness in this city. I've been in Montreal now. I've lived here, worked here for 30 years. And I can't believe how it's even gotten crazier from a fan knowledge point, from just people who absolutely love the game, love the Montreal Canadiens. What is it that has made the game grow to this point, in your opinion, that it's like now where people, like, you wouldn't believe the emails and the tweets and everything I get on a daily basis as to when this is going to end. They don't want to go somewhere else.
I think a lot of it, in terms of why they're more knowledgeable about that, is the media's work. There's so much competition in the media markets now that they're always looking for, you're always looking for new angles and new ways to present information. And I think the fans just have access to more information before. And part of it might also be like hockey pools or rotisserie leagues. That's also generated some buzz and more reasons to follow the game more closely. Those are probably the two reasons why fans are a little more attuned to what's going on than ever before.
Even revenues, like the revenues that have increased in the NHL to go from $1.3 billion to $3.3 billion now, in the span of, 7-8 years, is really quite remarkable when you think about it.
It is. Obviously, it's something we can be proud of. We didn't know if that's what was waiting for us at the other side of the work stoppage last time, just like we don't know what's waiting for us on the other side of the work stoppage this time. But yeah, overall, a lot could be said for the fact that revenues have grown significantly.
Does it bother the Tampa Bay Lightning, and I don't know how many players you have, if they've gone overseas to play or not. Does that bother the Lightning organization that you might fear something might happen there?
It's beyond our control. There's nothing we can do about it. So we can't get involved, so we're not getting involved. And the players that go, and the players that don't. Hopefully we'll be back playing NHL hockey quickly, and that's really all that matters.
I know we've received a lot of questions. Would you like to take some of the questions, or will you take some of the questions from the crowd that is here? Is it, with what you look at hockey in, what is the Sun Belt, or what we say the southern markets, and when you see the constant struggle of what has been going on in Phoenix over the years, I'm not sure why the people are selling all of a sudden the LA Kings, but timing is everything. Can realistically, Julian, and I know you guys have won a Stanley Cup in Tampa, long range once again, is it talk that needs to go away, or is it talk that that these cities can survive in the long run? Can they really survive, do you think, in the long run? And I know I'm asking you to comment about other cities that you don't know, but just a feeling.
I think they can strive. I think we can do more to survive. A good example is Dallas. The team moved to Dallas. There was no hockey culture in Dallas. Up until 2004, 2005, 2006, they were one of the highest revenue teams in the league. They were successful on ice. They had a good program. They had a good game presentation. They had a great building. They were a well-run organization, and the revenues were there. The fans were there. The ticket prices were there. So I think it's possible for all these franchises to strive.
We were talking earlier, and it's for people who don't know in the Tampa area, and like you said about how it's a struggle, and you're ahead of the game when it comes to other one. There were at times years ago, and I was telling you about a friend of mine who lives down in the in Florida, goes to a lot of the Tampa Bay Lightning games, and went to a concert, and it cost him and his wife $75 to go to the concert. And in return, he got two tickets to go to a Tampa Bay Lightning game for the $75. That was, I don't want to say the norm, but stuff like that happened. And you were telling me in the past, or even just recently, some of the deals that can be had.
Yeah, well, when you're trying to win back your fan base, you have to get them in the building to present your program, present your product, sell your product. If they come in and they taste it, they'll want to come back. Sometimes you have to do some of these promotions. But I remember when I started working for the Montreal Canadiens, that's the 2000-2001 season, the building was, we were 5,000 short of a sellout.
That's right.
Night in, night out, we were bleeding money, and things turned around. All these franchises can be turned around. A lot of things need to happen. Not every market has the revenue potential of Montreal, for example. Very few do, other than maybe Toronto. But all these markets can do well. A lot of them have done well for spurts. As long as the product has been of a certain level, and the team was winning, and the fans could be proud of their team, usually you're able to make a go at it.
Are there untapped markets out there? Do you think it would go in Quebec City?
I think it would go in Quebec City. There's you're talking about a market where there is a history, there's a fan base. And the number, it's not just the population in the city, but it's the number of those people that are hockey fans and that want the team. It's so high that I would believe that they would do well.
Plus, it would be terrific. You wouldn't believe, for people who don't know, the Nordique-Canadian rivalry was unbelievable. Question here from Jason is, we met during the internship with the Lightning in the 2011 playoffs. My question is, what kept you motivated during your studies, and how did you keep yourself going to be where you are today?
What kept me motivated when I was doing my MBA? Where's Jason? Was that the question?
Yeah.
Some of my colleagues who did the MBA with me are here to attest to that. My focus was really on my job, and the MBA, I tried to get as much of it as possible by putting as little of it in it as possible. So my focus is really on my job. That's where I owe the organization. They're paying my salary. They're paying part of my studies. And that's where I had the most interest. So it was relatively easy. The way the EMBA was structured, too, was one day a week. It was easy. I could schedule the rest of my week around that one day. It just made it very convenient. They took care of everything. You show up, breakfast is there, lunch is there. You can park your car. It was as easy of a program in terms of logistics as can be. And so it just worked. I don't know that I had to make many sacrifices doing the program. Not work-related, anyway. What helped too is I had great support with the Canadians. Bob Gates actually suggested I do the program. I had financial support from them. Everyone at the company knew I was doing the program, so I had great support, and it just made it easy. They knew if every other Friday I wasn't there, they scheduled work around it. They made it work.
When you hire someone, and a question here of like a Matt Carl over in between seasons, What are you looking for? And then also, how does it work, the whole process? Do you sit down with Steve, or is it a committee, or the two of you hash it out and figure we'll try and get this for this, or do you start here and work your way down, or start here and work your way up?
Well, you're always assessing needs. Every day we're assessing needs. How can we get better? Not just who the players are, but just in our way of doing things. And there are certain points of the year where we get a little more focused on the players because something's coming up, whether it's a trade deadline or a free agency for July 1 or with regards to amateur players when the draft comes up. So with regards to Matt Carl, for example, who was a free agent, was available on July 1, probably midway through the year, we have a list of who the free agents are going to be, and we have an idea of what our needs are going to be, and that's when we start sending our scouts to pay closer attention to specific players. We knew we needed to improve our defense. There weren't that many defensemen available. Matt Carr was one of them, and so we kept an eye on him. Steve and I also do it, but our scouts are heavily involved. And when the season ends, we kind of rate our Ds that are available. Where do they fit within our organization? How many of them can we fit? Can we afford them? And we kind of work from there. And then on July 1, it's a little bit like the floor at the stock market. Like, it's just everyone's on the phone and it's going really fast. And that's why there's something called buyer's remorse, too, because you never know how things are going to work out. But that's kind of how it goes. You put many months go into the planning. June, we spent a lot of time fine-tuning our list, doing a lot of video scouting in the office. And then by the time July 1 comes around, we know who hasn't signed by then. There's a lot of free agents signed between the end of the season and July 1, and they never become available to the 29 other teams. But July 1, we know who's available, we know who we want, and we go after.
Has there ever been anybody in the last couple of years where you've kind of went, damn, that got away from us?
Yes.
Who?
Well, I think when we missed out on Daniel Briere, in Montreal, that one stung a little bit. That one did, because we thought he was a very good fit for what we needed, and we thought our odds were good of getting him, and we did.
What about in Tampa?
In Tampa, it always depends what the expectations are. I think, considering what our expectations were the last couple of years on July 1, who was available and what the price was going to be for those players, I don't know that we missed out on many that we wanted. Mm-hmm. A lot of the free agents we wanted, we were most heavily interested in signing were our own players, and we've been able to re-sign all of them before they hit the market over the last 2 years. So I say we've done pretty well.
What's the craziest time of the year? Is the draft crazy?
It is for the amateur scouts or for the person running the draft. Obviously, draft week is probably the busiest week of the year, but that's not me. My busiest time is probably, well, right now, like training camp from about September to mid-October when, you know, there's a lot to do. You're setting up camp, you travel to preseason games, you have a lot of games in a short period of time, you're evaluating players. Then you have your minor league camp, you're doing the same thing there, you're deciding on cuts, you're meeting with players to tell them they're going to be assigned to another team, and you help the coach put the team together. So that's a busy period for us. And then late June, early July, the draft from July 1, that's another busy period.
You were saying earlier also about certain guys who would be playing in Syracuse this year that it'll be good for them.
I think so. Like, I think a lot of young players are going to benefit from the fact that this year they'll be playing at the American League level where they can have more impact, they can play a bigger role on the team, whereas if they had played in the NHL, they might play a smaller role on the team, maybe not get as much ice time, maybe not get as good an opportunity to improve as a player as they will playing, you know, 20 minutes a game in Syracuse. And I think when we come back, they'll just all be better player for
Connelly it. Connelly for one.
Brett Connelly, for example, who spent the year in the NHL with us last year as a 19-year-old, now he'll get to play in the NHL for the time being.
Question here from Emilio. Do you believe that we should have less teams in the NHL and less games played? And he has in brackets from 82 to 50.
Well, the games question is a revenue question. It's
right.
That simple. So it's hard to cut games. With regards to teams, it's hard for me being a Montreal Expo fan growing up and losing the team it's hard for me to tell other markets that they don't deserve a team, they shouldn't have a team. That the bonds that are, you know, built between, you know, a mom and his daughter or son going to games, watching a game on TV together, cheering for the local team, should be broken because of because we want to reduce the number of teams. It just doesn't sit right with me.
Questionnaire, and it was what we asked and talked about, of just the process of applying for a job as a general manager, and if someone was to go through what you were going through, how could they prepare themselves for that kind of process eventually?
Well, I don't think you actually apply for a job. Like, people know who the candidates are, and they know how to find the candidates, I guess. So usually whoever's doing the hiring is contacting you. It's not the other way around. And you prepare for the job when you don't have it. Like, in my case, I got a lot of my experience running minor league teams. That's how I got most of my management experience in terms of dealing with players and coaches. And in regards to the interview process, I guess each person is different as to how they go about it. It depends how well you know the organization that you're interviewing. But you certainly want to know as much about their players and their people and their philosophies and their values and their history as possible, so that you know what you're getting yourself into, and you can come in with an idea as to, okay, if I come in, this is what I'm going to do, this is how I'm going to go about doing things.
I always knew I wanted to do this. When I was 10 years old, I knew I was going to be on the radio. Nobody was going to tell me different. Okay. Did you always, what was your first choice of what you wanted to do that chose that you went along the career path of the school that, to be a lawyer? And
what I really wanted was to be a shortstop playing Major League Baseball.
Me too.
That's what I wanted. After that, really, when I was young, I always knew I was going to be a lawyer if I didn't play baseball. I can remember as far back as at least 10 years old knowing I wanted to be a lawyer. That's as far as the plan went for a while. And then I kind of decided I wanted to be a tax lawyer once I got into law school and did a little bit of tax work. I thought that was interesting. That didn't last long when I got into the real world. Literally, my first day on the job at the law firm, I went to see the tax partner and I told him I wanted to do tax law. And it was a Monday, and he said, by Friday, you're going to come back into my office and you're going to tell me you don't want to be a tax lawyer anymore. I said, no, you don't understand. I took all these courses, and I went to the U.S., and I took, you know, Masters of Taxation Law classes, and I really want to be a tax lawyer. And he gave me a file to work on, and by Friday morning, as soon as he showed up, I knocked on his door and said, here's your file, I don't want to be a tax lawyer anymore. I think I'll do corporate law. So I wanted to be a lawyer. That's as far as I had gone. And then when I started working, and I started being involved with NHL teams and representing them, and working with general managers and assistant general managers, getting to know them, getting to know the people at the league and the agents, that's when, actually it didn't come from me, it came from a general manager who said, you know what, you should be looking at working for a team because you've got something to contribute and some teams could use your services. And that general manager was Pierre Gauthier. He was general manager of the Anaheim Ducks back then. He's the first person who brought it up to me. And but I kind of let it be, and I just kept on working, and eventually someone did come calling. It was the Montreal Canadiens, so it's hard to say no.
It's hard to say no to the Canadiens, absolutely. You've worked with different people, Bob Gainey, Steve Yzerman, Pierre Gauthier.
Andre Savard.
What's the difference between them all? Or do they all, basically, their general managers, do they think alike or do they not?
No, they're all different. Like, every general manager is different. Just because of their experiences are different, their values are different, their strengths are different. They all had their way of doing things, their way of seeing things. So they were all completely different, to be honest.
What's the necessary personality you have to have as a general manager?
It comes down to leadership. That's the first, general manager, first quality leadership. Everything else will get sorted out. Head coach, first quality, leadership. Everything else will get sorted out. But it starts with leadership. You have to be able to, you know, set the standards, get the right players, the right coaches, the right staff, get them all to buy in as to how we're going to do things, what our standards are going to be. Ideally, you want to create a place where special things can happen, where players know this is where I want to be because it's different. It's special here. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. If you're a player and you're in that program, you say, you know what, I'm going to put the cause ahead of the individual because it feels right when I'm in this group to do that, because it's gratifying when I'm in this group to do that. That's what you want to build.
Can you learn that in school? Do you have to have that and learn everything else?
I don't know that you can learn that in school. I know I didn't.
Can you work on it in school?
Maybe. But like in everything else, if you want to be... When I was a lawyer and I was a practicing lawyer, I figured out if I wanted to be a really good lawyer, I need to work with really good lawyers. And they would show me what it is to be a good lawyer. My wife's a pharmacist. If she wanted to be a really good pharmacist, she had to work with really good pharmacists. If you're a doctor, you ought to work with really good doctors. If you're a teacher, you got to work with really good teachers. They'll show you what it is to be a good teacher. And it's the same thing in management.
Of all the people that you've worked with, what's the best thing that you've been able to kind of take from maybe all the individuals together in a group, or just one that you really remember a certain thing from one of them?
I got a lot from all of them. The general managers that I worked with, the assistant general managers that I've worked with, the coaches that I've worked with, the scouts that I've worked with. Honestly, I've been, like, the secret of my success is I've been really lucky. I've been blessed. I've been surrounded by great people, starting with my parents when I was born, all the way through. And then I was at the right place at the right time. So I took a lot from everyone. To the extent I deserve any credits, that I asked a lot of questions, and then I just took it all in.
Question here from someone. It says, the average forward in the NHL, 6'1", 205 pounds. The average defenseman, 6'2", 210. Goalies are all over 6 feet. Bigger, faster, more skilled. When is the NHL going to seriously look at changes to encourage flow and skill versus rugby on ice? Now, I know you're more from the financial side, but in conversation with general managers, with the people you work with and have worked with, is there conversation about the game itself?
Always.
Always?
I'm on the AHL competition committee. We discuss it all the time. Steve's on the NHL competition committee. Usually he discusses what they're discussing with me, kind of fix my brain, see what I think. Like, it's an ongoing process. It's a never-ending process. We're always trying to improve the product. From when I started in 2001 to now, the game has changed significantly. There are a lot more young players in the league, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old players who are contributing, a lot more small players contributing than when I started. And that's not by chance. Like, that, there's thought that went into it in terms of how we would apply the rules, what the rules would be in terms of increasing flow, increasing the speed of the game, and it's an ongoing process, a never-ending process.
The concussion issue is a concern, is it not, with
it
the
is.
NHL?
It has
sometimes, and I have to admit, sometimes we wonder if it is.
Oh, it is. It is from a league standpoint, I'm sure. It is from a team standpoint. We have an obligation to our players to keep them safe. We as hockey managers, we owe it to our players. We ask a lot of them, but we also have to do our best to keep them safe. And we have to look at concussions. The issue with concussions right now is that there's a lot that we don't know. We're finding out a lot at warp speed almost, but there's still a lot that we don't understand. And hopefully soon we'll have a better read as to how to treat it, how to prevent it, and take the appropriate steps.
Ready for a baseball question?
Sure.
All right. You used to be a baseball player. How do you think the baseball strike affected the Expos when they were peaking? And would they have survived longer without that lockup, which was a strike?
It's hard to tell. One thing I know from being in the business is that when you're inside the business, you have all the facts, or most of them anyway, and sometimes when you're out on the outside, you don't, but it doesn't stop us from forming opinions. So I don't have all the facts to know exactly if it would have made a difference, how big a difference, would it have saved the team, but it's hard to argue that it hurt, and it was a significant blow to the organization. And I don't know if that's what killed him or not, but it didn't help.
Oh, that's another four-day conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
What happened to the Montreal Expos? Don't get me going. Both of us are very huge, monstrous baseball fans. Could you briefly describe the extent the extent and nature of the interaction between the hockey operations of the business side of the organization, especially when it comes to marketing?
It probably depends from one organization to the next, and on the people that are involved. Ideally, you have a close-knit organization where everyone works together, where the marketing people are trying to help the hockey people, and the hockey people are trying to help the marketing people, because obviously, the better they do, the more revenue we have, the more fans we have in the building, which creates a better atmosphere for our players, and the better we do on the ice, that helps them sell sponsorships and tickets and get advertising and so forth and so on. So you kind of work as a team. And usually it's not that big an issue. Everyone knows that at the end of the day, it's about winning. The marketing people know it's about winning, that the best way we can help them do their job is to give them a good product, and they don't usually interfere in our schedule if we tell them that it might impede our competitiveness. Which is why usually you won't see a lot of marketing initiatives or player initiatives after a certain period of time when we get down to the stretch before the playoffs.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell made a comment that the biggest fear that the NFL has for the future is the big screen television, is that it's more comfortable, easier, more enjoyable, more affordable to stay at home. Do you think that will be a concern also of the NHL or anything similar to that?
I'm not an expert on the question, but I would say hockey's very different than football. Football might actually be a better sport, a better TV sport than a spectator sport. It's certainly not true for hockey. Like, the best way to experience a hockey game is to be sitting in the building, experiencing it live. So I don't think our level of concern is necessarily as great as the NFL. Mm-hmm. The other thing with the NFL is people follow 32 teams because of wagers, because of pools. So they want to be home on Sunday so they can watch every game. They have the Red Zone program where they actually have 8 or 16 games going at once. Our schedule is different. Our fans follow our league differently as well. So I don't know if it's a big concern for hockey.
We've seen another question. We've seen the NHL change into a young man's league in terms of players. How do you see the NHL changing now that younger generations are also working in NHL management? Example yourself, people like Mark Bergevin, et cetera, et cetera.
I think it's just, there are more younger people involved because there are just more people. When I started in 2000-2001, half the teams didn't have anyone with my kind of background. They just had your more traditional former hockey players, former hockey coaches working in management. Now every team has people with business experience or management experience. So we didn't replace the traditional hockey guys. We just was added to the team. So there's more jobs out there, which would explain why there's more young people out there. Hard to tell how and kind of the next generation of managers is going to impact the game, because I don't know. Like, time will tell. I don't know. But every generation comes in with their ideas, and over time the game evolves, and hopefully it evolves in the right direction.
Is it hard sometimes, and I don't know your involvement to the extent when it comes to this with the NHL. NHL could be old school, and there's some old school guys involved in it, with different teams and that. Is that hard to deal with sometimes? Because even as a guy who, I'm considered old school, and yet you hear and see some of the comments made by certain people, and you kind of go, ooh, it makes you cringe. Is it hard as a young executive when you see that? Obviously, without any names.
Yeah, no, I have never had any issues. Quite the opposite. Usually, people were eager to help, eager to share their knowledge, share their experience with me. Everyone, I don't remember a single person being or feeling that I was nagging anyone with questions, or usually they would volunteer information. I started with Andre Savard. He brought me in every meeting for the draft, for the free agents. Even though I had nothing to contribute in those meetings, I was just there to take it all in. And it continued with Bob, and now my role obviously is different because now I have more experience and I bring something else to the table with Steve. But I've never felt like I was a nuisance, or if anything, people like to debate. If they don't share their opinion, they like having the debate. It either makes them change their minds, and then they're happy because now they're right, or they're even more convinced that they're right, and that makes them happy too. So I've never, ever seen that. And some people think it's an age thing, but it's not. It's just a mentality thing. Some of the young people might have what others would consider old school philosophies, and some of the older gentlemen are actually really progressive. So,
The success last year in Norfolk must have been satisfying.
It was. It was fun. It was fun because when you win to the extent that we win, if you don't know, we won the championship last year, the Calder Cup. We also won our last 28 games of the regular season, which beat the previous record of 18 by 10. We lost three games from February on all the way through June. So we had a really good run. And when you win, it was the same thing when we won in Hamilton in 07. The bonds that you build with those people, they're lifelong bonds. Like there's a, I would see all these former Montreal players from the 86 team or the 93 team or the 70s, and they're all still buddies. And they may not have seen each other for 7 years, but it's as if they were out, you know, the night before having dinner. Winning just brings everyone so much closer. It's such a grind to win a championship in hockey, I think more so than any other sports, because of it's a two-month process. You go through four rounds. It's grueling. It's physically demanding. It's mentally demanding. And those bonds, like they last a lifetime. So that's what I get the most out of that.
How good was Carey Price that year with the Bulldogs?
He was outstanding. He was unbelievable. He was a difference maker.
Would you have won without him?
He probably not. We would have won without him, but others contributed as well. You can take out a lot of people from that team, and if they're not there, we don't win. It's really a collaborative effort. You need everyone pulling their weight.
There was never, and I used to tell people, and I still tell people on the radio all the time, was when they came down to the obvious argument as to who was better, Halak or Carey Price, and I would say to Pete, please, don't give me the sign. Carey Price. There was never any doubt there was ever going to be anybody but Carey Price, in your opinion.
I wouldn't say that. There was debate. They were both very good. There was some debate.
No, they were both, yeah.
Okay. And we revisited it often.
Really?
Yes.
Oh. It was fun to say, Halak. Was it difficult to leave Montreal?
It was, because, first of all, it's home. So there was kind of a personal life change. My family's here, my friends are here, my roots are here. This was comfortable, which is kind of why, from a professional standpoint, it was comfortable too, which is why I felt like it was time to go. If you want to grow, you got to work outside your comfort zone. Plus, I had a lot of friends, still do have a lot of friends within the Montreal Canadiens organization, some fabulous people who are amongst the best, if not the best, of what they do. And it was a privilege to, you know, work with them every day and learn from them. And so it was hard, but I knew it was the right thing to do. And I had no doubt it was, if I wanted to keep growing, I needed to go.
Two Calder Cup championships, though. You've done a good job.
Good players. You need good players.
Oh, come on. No, wait a minute. You've done a great job. You will be a general manager in the NHL, will you not?
That's not to decide.
Yes, you will. Yeah. Yes, you will. Without a doubt, someday. Are you superstitious?
Not at all.
Okay. No.
No. I don't know why, but I'm not. We had our streak going last year, and I talked about our streak to some of my friends who are either GMs or assistant GMs on other teams, and they said, "How can you talk about the streak? Like you're gonna jinx it." But it never crossed my mind.
I always ask this question of everybody because I try to find out when I first meet people some things about them that maybe other people just don't answer. When it comes to end of the world movies, what's your favorite, Independence Day or Armageddon? It's an ongoing thing I have to know.
I would think people would usually say Independence Day, but I'm going to go with Armageddon.
Yeah, me too.
The music was better.
Yeah. I think we're pretty well. Thanks very much, Julian. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Nice round of applause.